Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Show. I'm joined here today by Mr. Michael Morris. Michael, how are you doing, sir?
Fine, thank you, indeed. A little bit chilly in Cape Town, but sunny, which is a good thing.
No, definitely, definitely. And if, sorry, go ahead.
No. I was going to say, I hope all things are going well with you.
No, of course. And we are also joined by Mr. Marius Ruett, who will soon be returning to the motherland. What is it that you've missed most about SA while you've been away in the UK, Marius?
Oh, jeez. I have to think there's so many great things about the Republic. Probably peppermint crisp and Fanta grape. Steers burgers.
And of course, we are once again joined by our sponsor today, and that is Bitvice. Bitcoin is the complete hedge against the global debasement of money, inflation, and government overreach. Bitvice is a South African-first, Bitcoin-only self-custody solution that helps individuals and entities buy and hold Bitcoin for the long term. Bitvice believes that everyone should hold their own Bitcoin and trust no one else. Recently, there have been a plethora of crypto custodians going bankrupt, taking their clients' Bitcoin with them. This is why Bitcoin never holds your Bitcoin. They send it immediately to your own Bitcoin wallet where you hold the keys. Not your keys, not your coins. Simply sign up to Bitvice, link your bank account securely, and buy Bitcoin in seconds. Visit bitvice.io and begin your journey in buying and securing the scarcest asset that mankind's ever created. And we thank them very much for sponsoring the show today. Now let's get into the stories of today. And that is, of course, something from the Sowetan, which really did catch my eye because it seemed like, at least based off of the headline, that this was a story out of time and place. And yet here it was. And according to this report in the Sowetan, patients trying to attend an a hospital in Tswane, around Atteridgeville, were denied access by some people outside based on the color of their skin. You may think, well, what's going on here? Well, apparently, according to the report, Operation Dudula has been holding a protest outside of the hospital for most of August. And they decided yesterday to begin making sure that foreigners didn't access the hospitals. They would ask people, where is your home? And they apparently, according to the reporter, stopped people based on the color of their skin. If they looked too dark, they would be stopped. They also demanded to see proof of identification and that they had some kind of documents, their ID. They were also flagged by the protesters if they could only speak English, and none of the South African official African languages. Those people were the ones who were pulled aside by the protesters, were questioned about where they came from, what was the street name, and whether they had any documents. Apparently, the hospital got an interdict against them last week, but this didn't seem to do anything. That's not terribly surprising. We've covered many stories like that where the police don't act. Lots of people were turned away, including some. There was an old lady from Zimbabwe who was going there for cancer tests. A lot of people were very upset by this. Some people kind of fought back against the protesters, saying that they were just picking on people from Limpopo. There was a woman who was harassed outside, who was only let through once she spoke Pedi. However, she's a vendor woman who prefers to speak English, and she said that she's not particularly fluent in these other languages, and that's why she refused to speak them. Then, of course, there was also a lady interviewed by the reporter who welcomed this this protest outside and the checking of foreigners, saying that she has seen an improvement to the services of the hospital since they stopped foreigners from getting in. She said, she's a 71-year-old lady. She said, I come here twice a month at 5 a.m. for high blood pressure and sugar diabetes. We queue for long hours, usually because we find foreign nationals here already. Since this started, I have not stood for long. I usually finish at 1 p.m., but today I finished at 8:30 a.m. Sometimes we run out of medication and we get turned back, but that has not happened for the past few weeks. I think the operation is helping us. It's not that we don't want foreign nationals, but the space isn't enough for us all. Michael, let's start with you. What do you make of this story?
Yeah, very, very troubling, really, on so many levels. And that last comment, you know, it brings home to one how easy it is to make xenophobia or racism itself appealing. It can make life easier. This person is led to believe that all you need to do is to stop certain categories of people going to the hospital, and hey presto, you get quicker service, and life is better. And of course, it follows that if you do exclude members of a society or members of your community, even if they're not citizens, if you exclude them from normal social interchange and exchanges and so on, services, it is going to be easier, but it's profoundly disturbing on a moral and intellectual level. And it's really just it's avoiding looking at what the real problems are that are causing the shortages or causing the long delays and so on. So, yeah, very, very worrying. I was thinking also, I can't quite remember the wording, but the wording in the Population Registration Act of 1950 in defining different categories of people by race, one of the central ideas really was, you know, describing a white person is somebody who is self-evidently white, and we see this here, you know, that you can simply look at somebody and determine from their skin tone or ask them to open their mouths and say a few words, and depending on what language they speak, you can determine who they are and where they fit or where they don't fit. So, yeah, very, very distasteful. And of course, the other thing I think, which is also so obvious, is that the imprimatur has been given, the kind of permission has been given to society to behave like this from the highest authorities there, the MEC in Limpopo, Dr. Popi Ramatuba, just a week ago, making that scurrilous speech to a Zimbabwean patient. Absolutely shocking. Enormous damage it does to South Africa's reputation, our standing, both among ourselves, our self-respect, but also, you know, the regard that we expect from the rest of the world. This does enormous harm to that. And it's dreadful that people in senior positions like that are willing to in effect permit the, you know, sustaining this kind of xenophobic sentiment. So very harmful, I think.
So I have very complicated feelings on this. On one hand, I agree with you that this upsets me very greatly. And I also am outraged that sort of people are just kind of casually taking the law into their own hands like this. You know, I think it's one thing to defend one's life, property from crime and that kind of thing, but it's a different thing to go out and sort of actively enforce the law yourself. But on the other hand, I really understand where some of the Operation To Do guys are coming from. We know, and we'll get into this later in the show, that our hospitals are not well run, that there is a huge amount of wasteful expenditure, that there is massive problems with service delivery, that people do wait in queues forever, that there are shortages of medication, that kind of thing. And at the same time, there are huge numbers of people here illegally, who shouldn't have been here, who crossed the border illegally because the borders aren't enforced properly, that there's this general breakdown in law and order, that there's corruption, that people jump queues and get things they're not supposed to have, and all of that. And so I, you know, when the police are absent, I mean, there was a court interdict and the police didn't even show up to remove the protesters. This kind of, I think, speaks to the sort of environment that's going on here. I sort of get both sides. I don't know. Maurice, what do you make of all this?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of this is chickens coming home to roost. I do think there's a little bit of a moral panic. I'm not sure that, you know, foreigners are overrunning the South African government services, but I do think they're a large number of immigrants in South Africa, and probably a large proportion of them are probably without the proper documentation. And part of that is because, as you're saying, there's been no enforcement of on the borders and so on. But also part of the reason because of the collapse of Zimbabwe. And we all know, I mean, probably everybody who's listening will know at least a few Zimbabweans, whether like acquaintances or colleagues or whatever the case is. And that's because the ANC supported ZANU-PF and Rob Mugabe in various elections when it was clear they'd actually lost. And, you know, there's outright violence to make sure that Rob Mugabe and ZANU-PF who stayed in power which we saw the collapse of the Zimbabwean economy. And, you know, so many Zimbabweans have left, and not just come to South Africa, obviously. They've come to, you know, other Southern African countries, Australia, the UK, and what have you. But, yeah, so a lot of this is chickens coming home to roost. But it also, this isn't, it's obviously not even a South African phenomenon. You know, I think part of the reason Donald Trump was elected in the US is because people worried about immigration from Mexico and whatever. Part while Brexit happened, people felt there was too much immigration coming from Eastern Europe and whatever. And it's also not just a phenomenon in the developed world. We've seen it happen in India too. There's kinds of rhetoric against people, especially in border regions of India around Bangladesh. And there's kind of a nasty movement to say that Muslims can't be actual Indian citizens. So this definitely isn't a, you know, phenomenon that's restricted to South Africa. It's happening all over the world. And I think it's, yeah, it's just, and it's probably something that's going to be with us forever. Since, you know, since humans, 100,000 years ago, whatever it is, humans first left Africa, and humans have been moving around the planet since then. That's not something that's going to end. But it's definitely, I mean, yeah, that's, you obviously, I think there's, I mean, there's a complicated issue. We can't just say all these people, there's Operation Dudula people. Obviously, it's, you know, it's not very nice. You can't exactly go condone it. But if people do feel that there's competition for resources and we need, obviously, an economy that's growing, then at the same time, you can't turn away people, you know, for medical care just because they happen to be born in the wrong place or whatever. So it's a very complicated situation, but I think we are in the situation largely, or to, thanks to largely because of failures from the ANC government.
Right. And this is actually, I think, kind of goes back to, you know, some people ask us, you know, why does the Institute of Race Relations talk about so many things? Why does the Institute of Race Relations push so many policies that have nothing to do with race relations? Well, that's what they claim. But one of our central arguments and how we kind of view things, and it's illustrated perfectly here, is that when society is under stress, when society is dysfunctional, when society is poor, it makes these tensions kind of come to the surface and flare up, or politicians grab a hold of whatever racial, ethnic, religious, whatever tensions there are, and bring them up as a way to boost their own power. And that's why we advocate for the policies we do, because it's not simply, you know, you're never going to make all South Africans live in harmony with each other unless we have a safe, free, prosperous society. And I think that's exactly what we're seeing here is, you know, if the hospitals worked much better, if people didn't stand in queues for as long, if there were, you know, if there was a sense of law enforcement and the crime rate was like a third of what it is now, I seriously doubt that Operation Dudula would be able to get the traction that they do. Michael, final thoughts to you.
And I think, I mean, certainly the position that I would argue from it also incorporates this idea that that safe, free, prospering society is essentially an open society. It's closed societies are not capable of doing that. Closed societies are not capable to really deliver much that's useful and valuable to humans. And a humane, open society is one that is very likely, or much more likely, to succeed than any other kind. So focusing on, you know, shutting down borders or keeping people out and so on is, you know, from a purely administrative point of view, I think it's important to have proper border controls and a proper process of immigration and so on, to know who you've got in your country and to be able to plan to meet their needs and so on. But it's right, not
as, our colleague Tiago has pointed out, to get their fingerprints so that if they're involved in crime, you can track them.
Yeah, sure. I mean, there's just a straight off advantage. but none of that is going to solve the deficiencies in healthcare and hospitals, deficiencies in policing, administration, and so on. So, yeah, one certainly does hear the other side. I mean, I hear the other side, but it's not an alternative to me. The primary value is an open society that works, and that's the objective. And all these little efforts are really distractions from that.
Right. No, I think that is definitely the case, that the government is very keen at the moment to find something other than itself to blame for a lot of these issues.
Yeah.
All right, let's move on to our next story, and we will come back to hospitals, but we're going to talk about what was once the shining new kid on the block in South African politics that had one of the most spectacular falls in South African politics. And this is, of course, the political party, the Congress of the People, or COPE, as it's more familiarly known. So, as I'm sure everyone remembers, when was it formed? 2008, 2009, around that election, COPE did pretty well for a new party. They got 7% of the vote. They got 1 million votes, which is kind of around slightly more than what the EFF got when it launched in 2014. Pretty good result. There was also a lot of fanfare around it. A lot of ANC people went to join it. It had these heavy hitters. It had Masiwa Lokota. It had Mzima Shaloa. And raft of other people, and people really thought that a sort of COPE DA coalition might be able to take down the ANC. In fact, COPE itself, I remember hearing on the radio on my way to school at the time, some COPE spokesperson claiming they were going to get 51% of the votes in the 2009 election. Well, within a few years, COPE's vote had collapsed almost entirely. They went from 30 MPs in parliament down to, I think it was 3. And the party has struggled since. It still managed to maintain quite a lot of political relevance in the fact that it holds a number of seats in municipalities across the country, which have often been key to making coalitions work. For example, Tswane, COPE is currently one of the parties involved in the multi-party coalition there. Action SA, the DA, the Freedom Front Plus, and the ACDP and COPE all have a little bit of, all a part of that coalition. So they maintain their relevance, but things are not going well for the party, and I wonder whether it is finally the end. So its vote shrunk even more in the previous election, and it was announced on Monday afternoon by a number of senior members of COPE that COPE President Masiwa Lokota and National Chairperson had been suspended from the party. And that this was because Lokota was lacked energy and strength and had been dividing the party, creating factional breakaway groups and parallel structures. In response today, Lokota and people in his faction have retaliated and suspended the people who suspended him, notably Deputy President William Adisha and Dennis Bloom, who is the Secretary for Communications. In response to the allegations against him that he was lacking energy and dividing the party, Lokota said, "The media briefing and the press statement issued by the deputy president was a hasty and desperate attempt to save his own skin and those of his clique and to try and confuse the public by spreading falsehoods. Any hallucinations by William Adisha and his clique must be dismissed with contempt." Morris, what do you make of this? I mean, firstly, you know, where did COPE go wrong? Is this the end for the party? What do you make of all this?
Yeah, I mean, the COPE is probably one of the South Africa's great post-apartheid martyr beans. When it was formed, you know, it was formed in the reaction to Jacob Zuma becoming president of the ANC, and, you know, it was going to defend the constitution, and had quite a lot of crossover appeal. I remember at the time when they had the inaugural conference down in Bloemfontein, I think it was, there was an older white Afrikaans guy who came in, like he was kind of a Bob the Plumber thing, I think was the Barack Obama, he'd been elected the year before, and this kind of Bob the Plumber became this, avatar for, you know, white working class people who were supporting Barack Obama. And I think the same kind of thing with this guy that people sort of focused on with the first conference there in that COPE had. And yeah, I mean, like I said, they did better than the EFF did in their first election. They got 7% of the votes. They did pretty well. I think they came third, or they came second in 3 or 4 provinces, I think. Nearly 20% of the votes in the Northern Cape, about 14% in Eastern Cape. So they really had potential. And they, as I say, they had some heavy hitters, Masiwa Lokota, Mzima Shaloa, William Adisha, that Smuts Ngonyama, I think, at one stage. You know, so they had like some, and there was also rumors at the time that Thabo Mbeki and Trevor Manuel were actually, you know, behind the scenes involved with the COPE and what have you. And I think also the time somebody had asked Thabo Mbeki before the 2009 election if he was going to vote for the ANC, and he gave this kind of, you know, he didn't say right out, yes, I am going to. So it was quite interesting. But yeah, it's, I think part of the reasons also it was formed for, because it only opposed Jacob Zuma. There were, I don't know if there was that much ideological coherence within the party. There were people such as Philip Dexter, who is, if you're still following what Philip Dexter is saying, he's like some of the really weird kind of 1960s lefty rhetoric, you know, it's like very strange stuff, some of the stuff that comes out there. So I think part of it was, you know, there wasn't, it was only formed in opposition to Jacob Zuma. There wasn't really any ideological coherence behind it. And I think that's where we saw it happen. Also, we saw fighting between Mzima Shaloa and Masiwa Lokota. And I've seen the comments here. Somebody's talking about Willie Hong Hong Madisha, who I think he gave South Africa some of the best, one of the best parliamentary memes in recent South African history, where Willie Madisha was mocking, I think it was my Lady Pandor for her kind of cut glass English accent. So I think Willie Madisha will probably be remembered longer than Sibiya Kota and Cope. But yeah, it's a sad set of affairs. I mean, we'll probably see Cope kind of hanging on, but yeah, it's had a lot of potential, I think. And a lot of racial crossover appeal, I think. But yeah, it is what it is. And there's probably, you know, yeah. But also I think it shows that there is a market for this kind of, you know, constitutionalists who are non-racialists. And, you know, maybe Action SA could kind of fulfill this void, but then also they say some kind of weird things often too. So I don't know, yeah. It's a sad day, but I mean, I don't think anybody's too surprised as to what's happened to Cope.
Yeah, I'm very skeptical that they'll be able to recover from this. You know, I wonder, I'm sure some people vote for the party still because of Masiwa Lokota, but I just kind of struggle to see the reasons to vote for the party if you're not voting for Masiwa Lokota, particularly because every person in South Africa and his dog is going to start a party, I think, in the next couple of months. Michael, what do you make of this? Oh, sorry, before I get to you, Michael, in the comments here we're talking, and I'll just for the benefit of our audio listeners, I'll mention this. There's a great video of, as Mario said, Hong Hong. It is so childishly funny. It's incredible of Willie Madisha just being very annoying in Parliament and very rude to Naledi Pandor. It tickles me with delight. Michael, what do you make of this? What are your thoughts on Cope's demise and missed opportunity?
Well, the first thing I'm meant to be doing when the show's over is going to look for that video because I haven't seen it. It just sounds very funny. I could do with some childish laughter after all the stories we've been pouring over today. It's a kind of great shame in a way. If he's not a politician, then that's it and he's got to go. And I think politics does that to people. You know, they can, they might have great political ideas, but if they can't function as workaday politicians, I think politics has a way of just pushing them aside. I think it was G.K. Galbraith, if I'm not mistaken, or anyway, some great sort of political figure of the early years of the 20th century, who got a post in government, I think in Britain. I might be getting the name quite wrong, but a political commentator said of this person, who was a great sort of political figure, theorist, rum thing about XYZ. He just never got the hang of it, and I think that happens. You know, you can be very, very smart. You have great principles. You come from a really interesting background, have something to offer. And yet if you just can't pull off that thing that politics is, there's actually no point in going on. And the sad thing is this might be the point that Terry Lakota has reached. And the fact that I call him that is, a throwback to my first kind of coming across him. As a reporter, he was in the Delmas trial. I don't know if anyone remembers the Delmas trial, a very controversial trial involving, as far as I, it might have been the first, one of the key ones that involved collective action of a crowd. So it wasn't a question of determining the activities of individuals within the crowd, but determining the activity of the crowd enabled the court to find against all the members of the crowd. And that was in 1985. And then subsequently, after 1990, when I was covering politics, we got to know him as a couple of those people were very similar to him. Saki Makuzoba is another one. Very accessible, very very willing, very Mandela-like in a way, but of course, being at much lower level, they were much more accessible, so you could kind of get to know them as people, and they were very amenable.
Lokota was one of the few ANC politicians, I think, who made a big deal about the fact that he paid his traffic fines.
Yeah, I mean, that kind of thing, you know. So and you, so you had the sense of somebody who really might have had something worthwhile to offer. I think he had also Mandela's sort of vision of a greater South Africanness rather than a sectarian or an ethnic or a, you know, kind of divided view of the citizenry. I think he saw it very much as Mandela did, mostly, not always. So a shame. I think a shame, but yeah, politics is, I think, quite brutal in making that choice for people. You know. Yeah,
it is a bruising arena. Anything to add, Morris?
No, as I say, I think it's just the great one of South Africans post-apartheid might have been, you know, I think that kept the momentum. Good easier being a 20% party and been taking, you know, a big chunk of the ANC support away and could maybe see the ANC under 50% a bit sooner than 2024-2029.
No, very much. One of the great what-ifs of South African politics, there's actually quite a few of those. Mm. Of course, the 1948 election, I think, is probably the most interesting of those what-ifs. But anyway, let's move on to our final story. And, of course, we're coming back to this story, which I think is linked to the first one, that is the poor management of hospitals. So we did a story last week about the CEO of the Tembisa Hospital, Lerato Madayo, who had been accused of spending 500,000 rand on skinny jeans. I'm not sure why a hospital needs skinny jeans. She also was apparently she was connected by some to the murder of Babita Deokran, the whistleblower, because, of course, Babita Deokran was apparently looking to raise questions about corruption at the Tembisa Hospital. So some people have made accusations that she's somehow involved in all of that. But anyway, regardless of all of that, after a lot of public pressure, these very public scandals, the sort of murky crime connection may be going on, the Gauteng Premier David Makura suspended the CEO of Tembisa Hospital last week, Friday, I think it was. However, I'm getting her confused with the CFO. Her name is Ashley Mtunzi, the CEO of Tembisa Hospital. However, interestingly, the Institutional Labour Caucus, which I assume is sort of the union or doctors' organization at the Tembisa Hospital, has hit back at government for suspending the CEO, saying that she does not work for the premier, she works for the head of department, and that her suspension was improper and that they have undermined the rule of law and the good functioning of the hospital. Michael, what do you make of this?
Well, I mean, you know, coming on the heels of our first story, here's exactly a problem. I'm equally fascinated as you obviously are by this term Institutional Labour Caucus, but they're kind of unionized staff, presumably, who appear to be more willing to interrupt a kind of process that's trying to get to the heart of a problem, and in this way creating a new problem. It really doesn't make sense. And it's not to say that either Ashley Mtunzi or Lerato Madayo are guilty of anything, but if we are going to make any progress, we need to be able to investigate these things thoroughly.
Right, there's definitely space for investigation here.
Exactly. So it really just is, you know, it's another instance of cynicism creeping in. And the public, you know, this is the worst thing about it in a way, the public eventually not caring. And becoming cynical when we actually need a public that's invested and involved and willing to participate in civil society to produce gains and progress, and this goes in exactly the other direction.
Morris, what strikes me about this is that it once again seems like Labour is on the wrong side as part of the response to the suspension of the CEO here. And it's also weird for a Labour organisation to get very upset about the suspension of a CEO, but said that they encouraged the department to engage Labour on the issue for the sake of Labour peace and to ensure the hospital continues to run smoothly. Very briefly, what do you make of this?
Yeah, I don't even know what to make of it. It's just, you know, it's like we're saying before the show, it's a bit of a dog bites man story. You know, I'm sure there's probably links to ANC, whatever, within this Labour caucus, or whatever it's called. And yeah, as you say, I mean, the guy hasn't been, he's still going to go through due process. He's only been suspended. It's not like he's just been fired without any recourse or whatever. He's been suspended, which I would imagine is the normal way of doing things, where you're accused of wrongdoing, go through the process, and when he hasn't done anything wrong, then he, you know, he can start doing his job again. And he's probably been suspended on full pay. And as I say, he hasn't been fired or anything. So just, it's weird that, you know, it's like, it's a weird hill too for these guys to decide to die on. But yeah, that is what it is, I suppose.
Very much so. And as our last thing, this is a story that we decided not to do today. Apparently, in the last 2 years, government has spent 131 million rand in payment of salaries of public servants who were staying at home while on suspension over the past 2 years. So I think maybe Ashley Mtunza will be joining them. All right, so that's all the time we have for today. Please check out our sponsor, Bitvice. Also, like the video, leave us good podcast reviews, all that good stuff. And we will, of course, see you tomorrow on the Daily Fringe Show. Cheers, everyone.